Finance Conference Committee will come to order. First item on the agenda today, because of some of us need more clarifications and a little history on the Upper Mississippi River Project. And so we've asked some people to come. We're particularly concerned with how it came to be and how it came to be so like an emergency issue that it has to be done this year. And that what was the role of the state of Minnesota, and what's the role of the corporations. And we kind of would like to know who is at the table for the people. And we have some questions about the negotiation process, and then that leads us to item F. In the House proposal, which many people object to the wording of item F because of potential wetland mitigation problems. We want to clear up questions. I don't expect that today we would take votes, but we have limited amounts of time. We will be here today till 5:30. Which the House has to go back, and we could reconvene again after 9, depending on what the Senate schedule is. But between 5:30 and 9, we're busy.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you or your staff direct us to item F in the House bill?
It's Article, Article 5. Which in on the side by side starts on page 95, R95, and the lines in particular are 81.
Madam Chair, I think it's on page R104. House side lines 81.21 to 81.22.
Mr. Knopf?
Yes.
Thank you.
Welcome.
This one's going to be 81.
81.4.
That's good. I'm actually
R105. Yes. R105. Okay. I asked someone to come from Blandin, they're representing Blandin, and somebody representing DNR. Mr. Buckler, are you Blandin?
Yes.
And Mr. Peterson, DNR? Okay, you're at the table for the state?
Okay. You can sit, yeah.
Is this in the acquisition of the easement discussion and the Upper Mississippi River project? Do we start with you?
Are you looking? Who are you looking at, Madam Chair?
The two of you.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm Bob Buckler. I represent Blandin Paper Company. And I've asked Tom Duffus, who represents the Conservation Fund and who was involved directly in facilitating the easement discussions, to join me today and to give you the overview that you have requested. In as much as he has had a close involvement with the development of this project over many years.
Okay. So how did Mr. Duffus get involved with knowing that there was this great opportunity for the state to acquire the easements to these 180,000 acres? Is that right?
187.
Madam Chair and members, if you would allow me to defer to Mr. Duffus to respond to that question and to introduce the project, I think that it would respond not only to that question, but to give you the background that you have requested.
I think Senator wants to help first.
Yeah.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think it would be helpful probably if Mr. Peterson started out by giving us a brief history of the conservation easement in Minnesota, because this isn't like this is the first one that we've had. We've had some larger conservation easements. And then you may want to review the Forest for the Future quickly, too, because that's the forest legislation that was passed last year by the legislature, which makes this possible.
Good suggestion, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Peterson.
For the record, my name is Richard Peterson, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I'm the Forest for the Future and Forest Legacy Program Coordinator. And just very briefly, the background of forest conservation easements in the state. We began our easement program, our forest conservation easement program, about 10 years ago in 2000, when we began participating in the Federal Forest Legacy Program, which is a state-federal partnership to acquire conservation easements on important forest lands throughout the country and in Minnesota. Over the course of the last 8 or 9 years, the state has worked both with the federal program as well as independent of federal dollars to acquire approximately 25 conservation easements totaling just under 66,000 acres, including three easements that are of significant size: a 4,800-acre easement with the Potlatch Corporation, a 1,600-acre easement in south of Grand Rapids with Rylas, the Sugar Hills Project, and then the largest easement to date is a 51,000-acre easement with Forest Capital Partners, the purchaser of the former Boise Cascade Timberlands. As we were reviewing our state forest legacy conservation easement program a year ago with a group of stakeholders, the group of stakeholders made a number of recommendations that resulted in a report to the commissioner. Chief among their recommendations was to create a state forest conservation easement program modeled in part along the federal program model, but very much unique to Minnesota, so that Minnesota's priorities for conservation of forests that produce multiple benefits, recreation, jobs and timber productivity, and protection of ecological resources. Those three benefits were the key considerations in the creation of that new program. That program was recommended as a new program. The legislature in 2008 passed that bill that created the Minnesota Forest for the Future program. And as part of that passage, we have begun the implementation of the program. And this project is certainly the key kickoff project for that program. Among the things that we've identified in the program are the protection of our large blocks of timberlands across the northern part of the state. To put that into perspective, if you think of the map of Minnesota as a giant puzzle with each of the puzzle pieces representing an area of native habitat, to the west, the south, and the southwest most of the puzzle pieces are missing. We have very much a fragmented prairie, very much reduced prairie, similar for the Big Woods in south central Minnesota and for the oak savannas. But if you look to the northern part of the state, we still have a fairly intact picture with native habitats still present. And we have the opportunity through this program and other programs to ensure that we will have a functioning forest ecosystem that will endure over time. And so that provides maybe a broad context for where we got to where we are today. Specific to the Upper Mississippi Forest Project, the state was approached last early November, by the company with an interest in selling a conservation easement and with some fee sales as well to the state as part of this new program.
Excuse me, some what kind of sales?
There's a, in this conservation easement project, there's 187,000 acres of easement and approximately 1,300 acres of fee sale included in the overall project.
So fee?
Fee, yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry. So beginning in November then, the state began negotiations with the company, scoping out the project and beginning to review and draft the conservation easement terms. Tom Duffus with the Conservation Fund was mentioned. Tom Duffus participated by invitation of both parties as a facilitator, someone who is very knowledgeable, has a broad and deep background in forest conservation easements through many years with the Conservation Fund as well as the Nature Conservancy. So he was there as an impartial facilitator, assisting both the state and the company in bringing out issues and helping us refine our ideas on how to craft and draft the conservation easement. On the state side, in addition to myself, the regional director from Grand Rapids, Craig Engwall, and I were the state's negotiators. On the company side, Joe Maher and Jim Marshall represented the company. And over a series of several meetings, we drafted and negotiated the terms of the conservation easement, which were completed approximately by the end of the calendar year, the end of December. And based on,
Okay, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, you say that the state has participated in other easement purchases over time. Is it typical to have an impartial facilitator like Mr. Duffus involved in these projects, or is this one special for any particular reason?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have participated with other partners, notably the Trust for Public Land in four previous easements, the two Brainerd projects, the Sugar Hills, and the large easement with the Forest Capital Partners. So it was not an unusual situation. Again, the state negotiated on our own behalf. We did not either request or desire Mr. Duffus to negotiate on behalf of the state. And similarly, the company negotiated on their behalf. Tom Duffus, Mr. Duffus was there simply to facilitate the process and provide informed background as we proceeded. Again, we completed our draft easement on or about the first of the year, proceeded with a engaging an appraisal, had the pre-appraisal meeting. The appraisal was completed in March, was reviewed and certified, and based on a certified value, we negotiated a price with the company. Based on that price, we have finalized a funding value that we need to complete the project. So to date, our estimate for project funding is about is approximately $45 million, which is what we have requested in part through the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council's process. The funding is split into both private funding as well as anticipated state funding. The private funding comes from two grantors that will provide $9 million towards the purchase of this project, and leaving a remainder of $36 million that we are requesting over the 2 years from Lasard process and the legislature.
Would you repeat that again? 45 million?
The total request for the project is $45 million. The total acquisition part of that to purchase the fee and the easement is $44 million. The remaining million is split between approximately $100,000, which we have targeted for salaries over 2 years, $150,000 towards the various professional services that we require from Lands and Minerals, the survey, the Attorney General's review, and title work, all of that for $150,000. And then the remaining $750,000 we've requested to put towards a stewardship account similar to what has been proposed by Representative Wagenius that would be used to fund the monitoring and enforcement of the easement provisions over time.
Mr. Peterson, is the $9 million from private, is that public information?
The state has not directly been involved with the private fundraising. I would defer that to Mr. Duffus.
Mr. Duffus?
Madam Chair, members, Tom Duffus with the Conservation Fund. In addition to providing the technical expertise in facilitating the transaction, the Conservation Fund also has been raising private capital to match the public funding for this project, to extend the public pocketbook, as it were. And we have commitments right now totaling $9 million from private entities, and we are working to obviously try to fill in a few more gaps here and there, but that's primarily what we have. And the source of those funds, which are grants to the Conservation Fund, we are a nonprofit organization, which we would re-grant to the DNR at the real estate closing, is $2 million from the Richard King Mellon Foundation out of Pennsylvania, and the Blandin Foundation from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. So, excuse me, $7 million from Blandin, $2 million from Mellon, for a total of $9
million. And then, thank you very much. Mr. Peterson, then that $150,000 for salaries for whom? DNR?
A correction, Madam Chair. $100,000 would be towards salaries in DNR, and $150,000 would be to purchase professional services through the Lands and Minerals Division, as well as through the Attorney General's Office and other sources that may be needed to complete our due diligence for the project. Specific to the $100,000 for salary, that would we haven't identified necessarily who it would go to, but it certainly could provide my funding for myself or others that would be involved in the preparation of the property report, for example, the monitoring requirements that we will be implementing over time, doing the environmental assessment on the property and similar activities, reviewing the conservation or reviewing the forest management plan, a number of activities related to the project that we will need to be doing over the next year and a half.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Duffus,
go on.
Madam Chair.
What happened?
Members, again, my name is Tom Duffus, the Upper Midwest Director for the Conservation Fund. It's a national nonprofit land conservation organization. I live in Duluth. As was mentioned, I'm serving as a technical expert to the Upper Mississippi Forest project transaction. I do not represent the company, the landowner, or the DNR. And as has been mentioned, the Conservation Fund is raising private match for this project. This project has been in the works for 10 years, not for 4 months, but for 10 years. I have been personally building relationships and working on the prospects of a project like this for all of that time. The property, 277,000 acres for the conservation easement, was long ago identified as a priority for conservation by the County Biological Survey, the Nature Conservancy's Ecoregional Plan, which I participated in drafting, and others as an important unfragmented forested landscape. It's the largest intact northern hardwoods forest habitat in the upper and it's also in the upper Mississippi Flyway and the watershed of the upper Mississippi. There are over 60,000 acres of wetlands that are embedded within the forested habitat and other riparian resources. This land base supports and feeds 17 mills, 3,200 employees directly involved with that. It's also a very important recreation destination for residents and visitors alike. Recently, this property has been identified as a priority in the statewide conservation plan, and also, as was mentioned, the Minnesota Forest for the Future program, as well as other plans. The landowner, UPM Bland and Paper Company, based in Helsinki, Finland, and Grand Rapids, is known for its exemplary stewardship and ecologically based forest management. The last session of the legislature passed the Minnesota Forest for the Future law, which created the parameters for the DNR's program and highlighted the potential for the Upper Mississippi Forest Project as well as its priority. Though the landowner has been in casual discussions, as I mentioned, with the Conservation Fund, with the Nature Conservancy, and the DNR for a number of years, the forest field in Minnesota is a small group of people. It really was the passing of the Minnesota Forest for the Future law and this fall's amendment that enabled the DNR to enter into negotiations with the company and for them to respond in a serious way. I want to say that industrial forests are subject to an active real estate market with the timber investment class. Timber investors, in turn, have a pattern of fragmenting their forests. They are owners for about 7 to 12 years, as opposed to the 100 years that pulp and paper companies have typically owned and managed their forest land. In the first quarter of the calendar year 2009 alone, over 560,000 acres of similar lands sold to investors in the United States, according to the Timberland Markets report. And for instance, within the past week, Weyerhaeuser, which is one of three pulp and paper companies left that still owns its paper lands, its paper company lands in the country, Blandin, Wausau, Rayonier, and Weyerhaeuser. Weyerhaeuser announced that it will be selling 300,000 acres of its timberlands that is going to bring an expected $900 million. That's about $3,000 an acre. Working forest conservation easements have secured permanent public access and protected over 2.5 million acres in the United States over the past 10 years. Minnesota is not the first state to do this. This has been in the wake of a dramatic shift from the industrial ownership to the investment ownership class. I will say that the specifics about this project, the easement itself is $234 an acre, and it's 187,000 acres, and it's going to provide essentially permanent public access for outdoor recreation, permanent protection from any development and subdivision, which is extremely rare in these large working forest easements to have no development and no ability to carve off even an acre of land. It's keeping it as an unfragmented forest and provide assurance for the highest bar of forestry. property also will remain on the tax roll, so there will not be any PILT issues here at all. And the cost of managing the land will continue to be borne by the landowner and not the public. There have been some questions, as you've raised, about the urgency, why do this now? And I want to see if I can address that as best as I can in my position. As I mentioned, there's a demonstrated, documented trend for paper companies to sell their forest land. It's an anomaly that this paper company still owns its paper lands with the other three companies I mentioned. In Minnesota, it is the only paper company that still owns its lands. The others are owned by investors. Potlatch is a real estate investment trust. Forest Capital Partners is a combined real estate investment trust and a timber investment management organization. These companies don't exist any longer. It's more likely than less likely that an industrial owner will endeavor to liquidate its land. That is the trend. So we consider this urgent. We consider it a great opportunity because we have a willing seller right now. And why would we wait and run the risk that we might lose this land and be faced with a situation with an investment-type owner that will have very different motivations than the current landowner and perhaps not settle for quite the high bar of forest management and public access that this land, current landowner is very willing to provide permanently by encumbering its land with a conservation easement. Finally, I want to say that, as was mentioned by Mr. Peterson, the cost of this project is $45 million, $9 million of which I'm very pleased to say that we've been able to raise privately. But the public funding and the appropriation over 2 years is critical in order to make a timely closing for this property, which would be by the end of calendar year 2010. Beyond that, this opportunity may very well be lost. Thank you, Madam Chair.
What happens, Mr. Duffus, if Bland and Kimony sell out to somebody else?
Madam Chair, in the pre-conservation easement situation or the post-conservation easement situation?
Post.
Okay. I'll start with a post-conservation easement situation. The purpose of conservation easements is to permanently encumber the land and protect the resources, provide the access, no matter who owns the land. If we've written our easements well, and I have written over 325 of these, and some bad ones. I've written some bad ones and some good ones. I've learned over 25 years. But the goal is to protect these resources no matter who owns the land. Obviously, the landowner retains the right to sell the land, subject to the terms of the easement permanently. In the before situation, if the company or if the landowner were to sell the property without the conservation easement, as I explained, try to highlight the market, it's very likely that this would go to a timber investment management outfit that is representing an investment for institutional investors, primarily pension funds, high net worth individuals, foundations, other pooled funds that have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize return over the life of the investment. And these investments are generated in about a 7 to 12-year window, and they phase their income over time from timber management, but really it's a real estate investment. So they are under an obligation to look for areas where they could sell land that would have greater value as, for instance, a real estate development than it would as a timber revenue piece of property. So the pattern is large chunks of land, say 5,000-acre chunks, get sold to a land subdivider. And this happened recently with a potlatch piece just north of the Twin Cities. It was a little over 4,000 acres in that case. And then that land dealer, you'll see the signs on the billboards going up 35, will then sell off 40-acre lots and so forth. The other issue that these investors will pursue is if they can do some of that retail sale themselves over that 7 to 12-year period of time and sell 40-acre, 60-acre lots, and that brings with it roads and fragmentation.
What about pre?
That's the pre-situation. If they sold this without a conservation easement, that would be the fate of this property, given the track record of the other properties that have transferred. In the post-easement situation, the land could be sold and subject to the conservation easement, but the future owner would have to abide by and would be knowingly buying into the terms of the conservation easement. And frankly, there is a ready market to buy that type of property as well, but the investment is purely on the timber cash flows, the net present value of the timber, as opposed to factoring in development values, which have been stripped away by the conservation easement.
Okay. Mr. Duffus, you started out with 170,000 acres on the easements and $234 an acre. And how many acres of wetlands did you say that this contained?
Madam Chair, members, 187,277 acres of timber land. And the current mapping shows 60,000 acres of wetlands on the property, and I was informed yesterday that that is a low estimate because the satellite imagery and the classification of the computer mapping program doesn't really capture the very, very small, important wetlands like vernal pools. Those are managed as part of the forest management and protected, but they're not accounted for in the 60,000 acres. There are over 280 miles of stream and river frontage on the property and lake frontage on the property as well.
Did you use LIDAR to map?
Good for you. I did not do the mapping. You'd have to ask the company about their mapping or the DNR about the mapping. But your question also previously went to the dollars per acre, and it's roughly $234 an acre. Conservation easements typically are 30 to 50% of the value of the land.
Mr. Buckler, did you use LIDAR map?
Madam Chairman, I do not know the answer to that question, but I will inquire and get a reply to you. Is it LIDAR?
L-I-D.
Okay.
We're just into LIDAR this year. We learned about it. Mr. Peterson, when you go into negotiations like this with a company, how do the negotiations take place? You have a list of things you've got to get, and then you've got a list of things that you're willing to give, or what?
Madam Chair, members, we start off with a list of easement provisions that we would like to negotiate. On some of those, we have high expectations. For example, our expectation is on every large industrial or commercial easement property that we acquire that there will be some form of public access. We also have the expectation that every property we will try to minimize the amount of subdivision that will take place. It's not always zero subdivisions, as is the case here, but that is our target as we begin negotiations.
And that was one of your things.
On this particular project, Madam Chair, the end result of the negotiations are that there are zero divisions. This property will not be parcelized or divided in any shape, way, or form, with the exception that the state, if the state had an interest and the owners were willing to sell portions, for example, as an SNA or as inholdings in a state forest, that is the lone exception to the no subdivision requirement. Other requirements are that every easement that has forest management has a reserved right, requires that the landowner adhere to a set of standards that allows the landowner to continue to manage the timber resources, but in such a way that the the habitat, the wetlands, the wildlife, all of the environmental, cultural, historic resources on the property are protected. We also have a number of what are probably more minor things that we look at, road restrictions, restrictions on signage, and a variety of, I would consider, fairly minor issues, but issues that we think are critical in the overall picture of protecting the conservation values of the particular property. And each property is fairly unique, and so we do, to a greater or lesser degree, have some flexibility in negotiating some points. For example, if the property is already in several parcels, not one contiguous block, it may be more realistic to allow the landowner to divide into some reasonable number various for sale, but with the easement attached. However, our goal is to minimize that, because every future division implies an additional monitoring requirement for a new landowner. And so, again, our goal is zero divisions, zero development, public access on our large properties, and responsible, sustainable timber management.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, you mentioned one of the concerns the DNR has to do with maintenance of wetlands. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that played into this particular properties negotiation?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative, all of our easements are have very strong language, including this one, that protect wetlands, that would prohibit any wetland alteration, any wetland filling, any wetland drainage. Every single easement that we've done has very strong language, including this one, that would protect wetlands. And specific to the issue that was raised in the House bill, I believe, that would encumber or that would prohibit these easement properties from retaining their wetland credits. I guess it was our feeling that by putting that additional provision in, it would not provide any additional wetland protection. Our feeling is that the existing restrictions are sufficiently strong to protect wetlands, in addition to the existing laws on the book. We didn't feel that was necessary. And furthermore, the company had a desire to retain, reserve the rights for those wetland credits. And so in the easement that we drafted, we did not restrict that provision that they not retain those wetland credits.
Excuse me, Mr. Peterson, you said the company retains?
Madam Chair, through the easement, the company reserved the right to retain any wetland credits that might be associated with the property.
Subordinate to the easement.
Subordinate to the easement, obviously, right. So,
is that a usual thing, Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, most of the time we're silent on that point. And by being silent, the owner retains those rights. We do not restrict that easement. Further clarify, anything that we restrict has to be negotiated, number one. And in this case, the company requested that they would retain that right. And secondly, if we restricted it, we would have had to appraise it and add value to the overall easement. But again, we did not feel that further restrictions on the easements were necessary to protect the integrity of the wetlands.
Mr. Peterson, are the wetlands, are there any of the 60,000 acres of wetlands in need of restoration?
Madam Chair, none that I'm aware of. As much as I have seen these properties, these are very much natural functioning wetlands. These are not like wetlands in the parts of the state that have been drained or altered. These are functioning natural wetlands. And again, our easement provisions, we believe, sufficiently protect the integrity of those easement or of those wetlands.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple points that might be helpful. One, we haven't said anything about the fact that Blandon's lands are certified, are they not? Would somebody want to talk a little bit about who certified them and how that might bring wetlands into the picture?
Madam Chair, Senator Saxhog, thank you. Mr. Buckler's asked me to answer that because I'm intimately familiar with the forest management practices of this company. The company currently has two forest certification programs. In fact, it was, I think, one of the first in the state privately to have this. One was through an ISO 14001. That's an international standards organization standard that created a management protocol for addressing all the externalities of the paper company, including the management and stewardship of natural resources. It's a very strict protocol that they have to organize themselves, which also includes stakeholder input and so forth. On top of that, this paper company has achieved third-party certification from the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, the Sustainable Forestry Board, which is one of the two primary forest certification systems in the country, the other one being the Forest Stewardship Council. So they are certified. That certification is carried forward into the conservation easement, and the standards for forest management need to replicate that going forward into the future.
Representative Lilly.
I would just add one small follow-up because I want to, and this is a little more general, but I think we understand that these lands are right in the middle of the largest unpolluted aquifer in the United Lower 48. The largest used to be the Florida Everglades, and we kind of understand what happened to them. So this is a beautiful group of wetlands along with a great industrial forest. Mm-hmm.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Doofus. You said you have written about 325 of these, and I'm just wondering, with the credits, can you kind of just briefly tell us the difference in value with credits or without credits and what the value might be or the price differences? Out of the 325 you've done.
Well, not all those had this situation. I've been working for 25 years in this field, and that's the cumulative count. It's somewhat scary that I actually keep track of that. But, Madam Chair, thank you. The anecdote that I will give you is a working forest conservation easement. It was a very interesting project in the state of California where there is a cap-and-trade program that establishes a protocol for valuing carbon credits, for instance, and that was a marketable credit. In this case, we're talking about wetland credits, and I can't really think of a situation on a working forest conservation easement where the landowners actually then exercise the wetland mitigation credits. It's a very remote right. There are wetland mitigation banks in other states that have credits allocated to the similar quality of wetlands that you find in this property. In other words, wetlands that don't need to be restored, wetlands that would not be created, but wetlands that are in a sort of a preservation status. That would be primarily in the state of Texas, where the Conservation Fund is actually in partnership with the state of Texas on a very large wetland mitigation bank. That'll end up being a property that once we acquired the property and once we sell those credits off of the bank, we will then be able to donate the land to the state of Texas. This is about 36,000 acres. So I can't answer directly about that case. This is a very remote situation. However, all of the conservation easements that I've been involved with have been silent on wetland mitigation credits within the past few years. Have been three or four that I have been involved with where it's actually spelled out not as a silent right, but it actually is included in the landowner having the right to sell the land, retain its wetland mitigation credits for future sale subject to the easement and so forth. But whether those, I've not seen those exercised.
Mr. Peterson, in the future, do you see the DNR changing their policy on the possible wetland credits and retaining them?
Madam Chair, at this point, I don't believe that we would change our policy in terms of negotiating to extinguish. If I understand your question, are you inquiring whether or not we would in the future extinguish those rights?
We would seek to
continue our current policy of either remaining silent. Again, we believe that the wetlands are adequately, sufficiently, legally, and otherwise protected under the what we think are very strong protection language in the conservation easement.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I understand your statement that the wetlands are protected under this easement that you're proposing. What I want us to wrestle with is how does this, since these are pristine wetlands, how does this relate to Minnesota's no net loss wetlands policy?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I guess I would defer to somebody like Mr. Jaski from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, who certainly has policy background in this arena. But
okay, and Mr. Peterson, when you go into a negotiation, a new negotiations, then do you have someone from that agency? Do you consult with them before you decide you're going to remain silent?
Madam Chair, we have not in the past. We certainly have general discussions with a variety of resources, all of our easements. I mean, there are easements in the past that have covered cultural resources, and so we consult with our state archaeologists that are employed within the Division of Forestry on guidance to protect those specific resources. Similarly, with rare species, the Division of Forestry would consult with our Ecological Resources Division on expertise there. So we're certainly would welcome, outside resources as they're applicable to the terms of the easement.
Okay, Representative Guinness.
So help me with my understanding here. So if the company retains the rights to wetlands credits, that, of course, means that they could sell those credits at some future date. And it's the selling of those credits that I'm trying to understand how that sale would relate to our known net loss wetlands policy.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I understand where your question is, and under our current easement policy, yes, the owner would retain that right to sell those credits if, in fact, there was a market for undamaged wetlands. Again, I'm not familiar enough with that issue to properly respond. Again, I think certainly it would be our intention to work within full understanding of the law and both the letter and the spirit of that law.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, just thinking about the spirit of the law, that if those rights were sold, and obviously there's a potential market there, then somebody who is going to destroy a wetland would have an opportunity to buy one of these credits. So then, in the aggregate, we would be out a wetland. And if we sold all the rights, we'd be out 60,000 acres of wetlands. And maybe that wouldn't happen in Minnesota, but it could potentially happen in another state, could it not?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, that possibility certainly exists. My sense of where that credit might go is that it wouldn't necessarily be a one-to-one exchange, so that 60,000 acres of pristine wetlands would equate to 60,000 acres of lost wetlands. There could be a much higher ratio of, you know, throw out 100-to-1 or something. Again, I think, as Mr. Duffus has pointed out, the potential and the possibility of that market developing for pristine wetlands providing that credit is probably relatively low compared to restorable wetlands that could create that credit. But again, I don't profess to know that market or that policy.
I believe
Mr. Jaski, if he were willing, could possibly answer a better policy question, which I think that is.
Representative Wagenius.
But it's DNR that's doing the negotiation, so it's really not a question for Mr. Jaski. Here's my concern. I'm thinking of our duck hunters and the migratory waterfowl and needing a place to rest in Missouri or Iowa, or even if we kept our no net loss wetlands policy, which we do have, then another state would say, well, we're going to get rid of the, or in another state, somebody's going to say, well, we're going to get rid of our wetlands, and we can buy that credit in Minnesota. And when that happens, then perhaps the ducks that we want to fly up along the Mississippi Flyway won't have a spot to rest coming up. So it seems to me that this, what DNR is doing is not abiding by the spirit of our no net loss state law and policy. And it seems to me if the possibility is truly remote that these credits would be sold, then our purchasing those rights would be relatively cheap. Would it not?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, I wouldn't disagree with that. again, I don't believe we have taken up this as a general policy question. At least I have not participated within the department in those policy questions. Certainly appears to be something that is of ongoing interest in the legislature, and certainly is something that I believe that we would review our current policy and consider that going forward.
Madam Chair, if I could add.
Mr. Duffus.
Thank you. I believe the Bowser, the state agency that exists, has to regulate, create wetland credits before they can even be sold or monetized. So I believe, and this is not my area of expertise, but I believe that there is a process in place for any landowner who wants to go and create some sort of a wetland mitigation bank, and there's a process, and these might not even qualify, or if they do, they might have such little value that it's not worth it.
Mr. Representative Guinness.
I think we're talking about two different issues here. You're talking about restorable wetlands in Minnesota, and that's what our Bowser deals with, is restorable wetlands, and we're talking about something different here. And we're not talking about restorable wetlands. These are pristine wetlands that we already have, that are sitting there. We do have a restorable wetlands policy, and that is what Bowser deals with. So we're trying to hone in on these pristine wetlands where if we don't purchase the credits and they're retained, then I don't expect them to be sold in Minnesota. It's that they would be sold in some other state. And then it's the concern about our friends in the migratory bird community, ducks, and as they come up our Mississippi flyway, might not have a spot to rest, and that we are not abiding by the spirit of our own law.
Madam Chair, we need to take a vote. We'll be right back.
Should we wait?
Yeah, I hope so. It's going to be rich. It's going to be like that. So.
All right.
We'll wait.
Oh, you take.
They must have done it when we were doing that stimulus.
I think you might say.
Mr. Jaski, could you? We're pausing now. Now the senators come back, but Mr. Jaski, could you come?
Thank you.
question. Marshall's going to know that.
So the issue was not preserved. The issue was that I think two wetlands on both global or national.
Somebody asked.
That was fast. How come? Representative Saxon, how can you move so fast?
I don't know. Maybe somebody was detoured to another room.
He's very nimble.
Representative Cohen went really long. Okay.
We understand. Madam Chair, in answer. I think it would be helpful, Representative Wagenius, if we did maybe at some point down the line get Mr. Jaskie here.
He's here. But we just hadn't finished with Mr. Martin
and
Mr. Peterson yet, and Mr. Duffus, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Mr. Peterson, I wanted to go back to some of the other rights reserved by the seller. And I thought there was some discussion about carbon credits, and so are there carbon credits reserved by the seller too? Then we're not purchasing carbon credits at all.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, in this situation, yes, the company has reserved those credits. And again, typically, we would be silent on those.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Peterson, anything that's not really explicitly purchased in the agreement, that if you're silent on it, let's say it's wind credits or water rights, or I know we have different laws in other states, but if they're silent, then they're reserved by the seller. Would that be correct?
Subject to the easement.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. Obviously, subject to the other terms of the easement, those that are not explicitly restricted are reserved rights.
Madam Chair, clarification.
Mr. Duffus.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, just a clarification on that. It's typical drafting. Standard for conservation easements that there is a statement in there that essentially says nothing that's been specifically transferred or restricted is retained by the landowner subject to the terms of the easement, including nothing can be, no rights can be exercised that will be detrimental to the conservation values that are identified on the property and the purposes for which the conservation easement is being acquired. So there is a very nice catch-all phrase that anything that's unforeseen in the future it has not been accomplished through that, specifically with the easement, there is a means by which to continue to protect the land if some other right that we don't understand the technology of now comes about in the future. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, you were explaining earlier what the DNR's practice was on previous conservation easements. And maybe I misheard you. What I heard you say was you have all easement negotiations have strict language to preserve wetlands. Now, there seems to be an issue here with the wetland mitigation credits. And what I hear you saying is that you're usually silent on this. Now, I guess I'd like you to clarify. Are you always silent on this? Have there been times in the past when the DNR has negotiated contract language on a conservation easement that involves wetland mitigation credits specifically?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Peterson.
We have never explicitly mentioned wetland credits in previous easements that I can recall.
Mr. Peterson, does DNR have any plans to develop a procedure down the road for perhaps changing your procedures when you're doing easement purchases or easement
Madam Chair,
Purchases.
We continually evaluate the program, and in fact, under the new guidance of the Minnesota Forest for the Future program, we have built in an annual program review to review our practices, policies, procedures in the effort to improve what we're doing, improve the practice. And so in a general sense, yes, we're interested in improving the quality of all of the work that we do.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I understand about the reservation of rights. However, when Blandon specifically asked to reserve the wetlands right, the right to sell credits, did DNR think through what this meant for the Minnesota no net loss policy? And specifically thinking through when you were using money from a fund that's been given to all of us by Minnesotans that says protect wetlands.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius. Again, whether or not the language is explicit or silent, the end result was the same and consistent with the way that we had conducted business in the past.
But if I could, Madam Chair.
Representative Guinness.
It was consistent. But when Blandon brings up the possibility of we want those rights, did it not trigger in your mind that Minnesota has a no-let-loss policy, for one, and that you would be spending dollars for this easement that had been generated by Minnesotans who said specifically these dollars are not only to protect forest, that's a good deal, but also to protect wetlands?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, our focus was to protect specifically these 187,277 acres in a manner through the terms of the easement that would do that. And I believe then and I believe now that we have protected 60,000 acres of wetlands. We don't know what speculative market there may or may not be into the future. There may be all kinds of unintended consequences that we're not aware of. It is certainly not my belief that by being explicit as opposed to being silent, that we have in any way jeopardized the wetlands.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the discussion is good. Obviously, the 60,000 of wetlands are going to be well protected. We're buying development rights. We're buying access rights. We aren't buying timber rights. We aren't buying water below the ground. In fact, if you sell too many of those rights, you might as well buy a fee title. You know, we'll just buy the 180,000 acres. We don't have enough money to do that, though. But I just believe in a state that values it's areas for recreation that has so many jobs that are involved in the wood industry, and values its wildlife that this is a great buy, and I really think that we need to be very careful. I handed out on page R5, where it deals with forests specifically in the first article, in the Senate side, it refers in 4.32 to section 8466. And for any of you that are wondering, that's what Forest of the Future is. And that's the statute that I handed out. I think it's it was done last year. I think the legislature did a good job and a good thing in doing it, and it was in anticipation that some of these conservation easements would come up, and that we didn't want to depend on the federal language or other states' language. We thought we should write our own law, and that's what's happened. So, I agree with the whole wetlands idea, but I think that's not what we're buying right here. But even though we are protecting a whole heck of a lot of wetlands.
Senator Saxon, what did you mean when you said we bought the rights of development?
We bought the rights that UPM Kimini cannot develop their land, subdivide and develop their land. And we bought access rights. In other words, that land needs to be accessible to the public forever. Those are the two major rights, I think, that we buy with these conservation easements.
Senator, did you discuss in these rights the right of the people to have any of the funds that the company was going to get when they sell their wetland credits?
Wetlands is Madam Chair, is Mr. Peterson has said, wetlands credits hasn't really ever come into the equation, you know, whether they're worth money or not or whatever. But no, they haven't.
Came to our attention, and so we were kind of wondering if we had to discuss it for the people 20 years from now, because I bet we have an article from a Texas, 19,000 acres it was, and it sounded like the biggest economic development thing to have happened to this town was that they had 19,000 acres that they were putting in this bank for wetlands mediation. It was just like it was the greatest thing that they had ever discovered. And they were going to sell them to Louisiana.
Madam Chair, I don't think Louisiana needs any wetlands.
And that,
but maybe Arizona.
And
yes.
That made us think. Go ahead. I would like Mr. Jasky to come up. We will draw this to a close soon.
Pardon?
Yeah. Mr. Jasky, you've heard the issues, and we are concerned about the future, and I guess we, you know, this is a good thing. We're getting timber, wood products off the land, and then the people have the access to the land for recreation, and at $234 an acre, we can't deny that that's not a good price. We think that's a good price. But we are concerned about the future and future credits. Do you have any comments?
Madam Chair, John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. And our agency is responsible for overseeing the Wetland Conservation Act, which protects the wetlands of the state of Minnesota. And also, as part of that, we manage the wetland banking program in the state, which allows parties to establish wetland credits for future sales to those that are going to be turning or filling one somewhere else. I'll try and keep it brief. There's three ways to establish wetland credits. Two of them have been long
tested and been in place since the law was passed in 1991. As Representative Guineas mentioned, you can restore a wetland, which is the way most of these are done, where you take an existing wetland that's been drained or filled and restore it to its natural circumstances. You can create a wetland in some places where you make one where nature hadn't put one, but where the conditions allow for it. And finally, in a very limited way, you can preserve a wetland for credit, but it has to have two conditions that are met. First of all, it has to be pristine, which is a high-quality site. But most importantly, it has to be threatened in some way, so that there's a threat that that high-quality wetland would go away but for this protection that would be put in place to preserve it for future mitigation use. The steps to establish credits are, first, you have to, as the landowner who has the rights to do that, they have to propose the site meet these conditions. There's a variety of things in the rule and statute that condition that. And then once that is in place and approved and the legal rights to control the land are shown, the state then approves that in an easement, if it one's already there, is put in place to preserve that wetland in perpetuity. And at that point, the party who establishes the credits may choose to either use those credits for their own needs if they're going to be draining or filling wetlands at some point, or they can sell those to parties that may not have another way to accomplish their mitigation requirements. And so I'm not familiar with the details of this particular easement that's being pursued in this particular site. My understanding is that they're pursuing the right to curtail development and the right for public access, and that other rights are either silent or not included. If that were the case, there could be an opportunity to establish credits here. However, because of what I said earlier, the fact that they are not threatened, under Minnesota law, there would be very, very little opportunity to establish credits on this site, given what I know about it today, which is I haven't been on site to establish that. And, of course, our laws in Minnesota don't address uses of these lands for offsets in other parts of the country or other parts of the world. But we do require any sale of those credits or use of those credits to be reported to the state to make sure we do the debiting to make sure no net loss is, of course, met.
And we are also concerned, there are, of these 187,000 acres and the 60,000 acres of pristine wetlands. There are 17 counties that are over 80% wetlands, and five of these counties are in these 187,000 acres, these 187,000 acres are in five counties in here. And we also are very concerned that if these 17 counties have over 80% of their lands in wetlands, we don't want to do unusual harm to them either or upset their opportunities to mitigate and have development. Mr. Jaskin.
Madam Chair and members, this is the first year I thought we weren't going to be discussing wetland regulations in front of a legislative body, but we almost made it. But in 2 years ago, we had a major package of changes that made improvements to the law. And last year, there was a single change made, I think, that Senator Sachsog and Representative Anzels pursued that dealt with this issue of getting some credit for preserving wetlands that were pristine and threatened. That's been incorporated into our rulemaking now. And so my belief is that there will be many, many other much more likely places to establish wetland credits than this site that we're being discussing here today. I think, the counties control land that has more opportunity to restore wetlands on it, as does the state. So I would think that this would be one of the last places one would look to establish wetland credits for the state of Minnesota's purposes.
But what about the 17 counties' purposes or the five county purposes?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I meant to say that when I say state of Minnesota, I meant all of the land within Minnesota, including all the local governments and private landowners who own property in the state of Minnesota.
And it's my understanding that those five counties and seven within the 17 counties would like to be able to do some of their own mitigation in their own areas.
Madam Chair, yes, they have that opportunity, that right, and those projects are given full scrutiny under the state statutes and rules that are afforded to the wetland mitigation standards. And I expect that they have done that, and they will be doing more of it in the future if they have needs for mitigation in that part of the state.
And, Mr. Jasky, when will your rulemaking be completed?
Madam Chair, based on the 2007 legislation, we have a two-year deadline, which is August 6th of this year.
So if this hadn't been such an emergency, would we have made any changes in the decision-making of the Outdoor Council?
Madam Chair, I don't believe there's any correlation between the two whatsoever.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Anasti, do you have any opinions that would help us? Senator Saxon?
Well, on a lighter note, Madam Chair, before Mr. Anasti gets up, you know, I really believe that if we don't do a better job of controlling the beaver population up in these counties, that we actually have a net gain of wetlands each year.
Got any ideas, Senator?
The beaver hat went out of style almost a century and a half ago.
Maybe it's time to change fashion. Mr. Anasti, can you help us in any way?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Arnosti. I'm a board member of the National Audubon Society here in Minnesota and have a long history with the state wetlands law, as many of you know. I'll provide a few comments that represent Audubon, and then I'll give you some personal opinions, and I'll delineate those for you. The National Audubon Society, Audubon, Minnesota, does support this appropriation and the acquisition of this easement. We do think it's a very good buy and a very appropriate expenditures of funds for the conservation values indicated. I personally share that as well, certainly. Now I'll provide my personal opinions, because that's what you've asked for. I think what we're touching on, what the House position is touching on, is something that's very important for the state to consider. And I think, personally, I think it was an error on the part of the Department of Natural Resources to not consider what has been happening in terms of derivatives. What we're talking about here is potential future destruction of resources, probably not in Minnesota, that will be so-called offset by paying, whether it's for a carbon credit, a wetland credit, it could be a future clean water credit. There could be all kinds of commodification that will happen to our natural resource values. And I think what the House position is talking about is the idea that we here in Minnesota, and speaking as a conservationist, I certainly hold this position, and I believe the majority of people in the state do. We do not want to be part of a system that pretends to save resources in one place at the expense of another. I personally believe that the easement, and while I have not seen the easement as well, I don't know anybody who's seen the easement, actually, the actual language, but I don't believe that the wetlands or the resources in Minnesota are at risk with this language. I think we've probably done a very good job of locking those up. What I think the House position is concerned about is that we don't want to be party to a loss of wetlands or polluted groundwater or carbon emissions or something like that in another part of either our nation or the world. And while those markets are in some cases imaginary or being imagined right now, in other cases emerging and just happening, now is the time to extinguish those rights and not be a part of that. And what I would suggest as perhaps a resolution to this is to proceed with the acquisition of this easement as indicated, because it's a very good one, but perhaps to direct that in the future the Department of Natural Resources or others who are acquiring conservation easements like this should seek to acquire all rights to the public resources that we're trying to protect. At this point in time, my guess would be those rights would be very inexpensive, because it's very speculative whether these markets would occur. But we could close the door on being a party, perhaps, to loss of wetlands in South Dakota, for example. We have no idea. There are states. I'm personally familiar with the state of South Carolina, for example, where their state wetlands law does allow developers to destroy wetlands and pay money to protect other wetlands that are in existence, and they facilitate a continued net loss. This sort of policy easily could happen between states, including those states, for instance, like South Dakota, where many of our birds and wildlife go to breed and live. And we do not want to be a party of that. So perhaps a resolution would be to proceed with this, but to indicate in the future the DNR should acquire all rights to these public values unless there's a darn good reason not to and they can come back and explain it.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anasthi, would a darn good reason be that you'd never acquire that parcel in the first place without those rights being retained by the seller?
Certainly, that might very well be if the other, if the seller is not willing to sell without that, and we're talking hypotheticals here, but I think in this case we had a seller, and again, I'm just hearing this on hearsay. I was not in the room. I didn't hear it. But we had a seller that inquired whether the state was interested in getting additional rights to protect these resources. And apparently we had an opportunity to say yes or no, and we said no. It might have been a good, in retrospect, Monday morning quarterbacking, it might have been a good idea to say we want all rights to these resources. And my guess would be it would probably be a few dollars an acre is what we would be talking about, not to be part of these gains.
Just to follow up on that, Madam Chair, Mr. Anasthi, we just heard testimony.
Senator Chaudhry.
Just heard testimony earlier that it is a matter of course in these easements to remain silent, and that it on that question, and that it is presumed that the seller will retain those rights. So it seems to me to be far from a hypothetical, but really a reality. Don't you agree,
Mr. Anasthi?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, we are entering a new era where people are creating markets in things that even a few years ago nobody conceived of. And so I think from a forward-looking perspective, and that's why perhaps I can't fault the people who have involved to date, we need to project forward. And again, speaking for myself as a conservationist who's been involved in these things for 20 years, I believe we want no part of the financial manipulators who have destroyed the economy of this country, manipulated the cost of raw materials and goods, and frankly, they're moving into natural resources. And I think it is important to identify this issue and say that the resources that we're going to protect in the state of Minnesota will not be used as an offset for resource destruction elsewhere.
Last point, Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Anasthi, you can feel free to respond or not. That's fine. It's just really rhetorical. I mean, I think it's fine to talk about these concepts in a vacuum, but the real context of it, of this is that Minnesota would not have a policy of no net loss of wetlands without these credits, and that is just how we have been able to take the steps we have to date, which would not have been able to be made without these credits. To your last kind of a philosophical concept, I read a book called, and many people have heard of it, called Nature Capitalism. And it talks about the good sides and the bad sides of our natural resource assets. So I don't accept that market forces cannot play a positive role in preserving our natural resources. You need only look to the mechanisms in place for reducing greenhouse gases where it can play a very positive role. And so just to simply discount that the use of credits in helping participation in our no-net loss policies is just something that I disagree with. As someone who has to help make this stuff work.
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I think we need to distinguish between two things. a regulated market in credits, I support. And I think under our state law, we have that regulation. We have very carefully thought out balance between how do we do development and continue to allow economic activity and replace wetlands using a market credit system. I support that. The Audubon Society supports that and has spent 20 years working on the policy with policymakers to derive that. What we're really talking about are as yet uncreated markets, many of which are of little to no regulation. They'll be beyond your control. And I think the House position, as I interpret it, is trying to suggest that, for instance, and I'll just take a hypothetical. What if the parent company in Finland that owns this land decides under Kyoto Protocol, which their country has signed on to, that they're going to destroy some wetlands in Finland and replace them by a bookkeeping entry with their subsidiary in Minnesota? That could be a market credit. That could be a wetland credit. What we're talking about is trying to slam the door on speculators and unregulated markets. That's what I believe is important to, in a forward-looking way, say we don't want to be a part of that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Buckler? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Duffus, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we have information to clarify. Thank you, Senators.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, is Mr. Peterson's on his way out, or if he could answer a question? I was just wondering.
I bet he's still here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson?
I was just curious how many more of these forest easements, if any, that you're negotiating, you know, now or in the, you know, right now.
Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative, currently we are, we have six additional easement projects in process. And by in process, I mean that we have negotiated the easement terms and are undergoing the appraisal. In addition to that, we have several other interested landowners that we have not yet begun acquisition.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
And thank you, Mr. Peterson. And just kind of give me an idea how much money we're talking and how many acres kind of through this, these additional parcels.
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Representative, currently the approximate acres of those six projects is 78,000 acres. And as I indicated, we are currently appraising those, so we have no values as yet determined.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Peterson.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, are those from the prior, I mean, I think there was a backlog of forest legacy appropriations from prior years that you were in prep. Are those for those projects that the legislature has appropriated for before, are those new proposals that will be coming to us in the future?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Representative Hansen, funding that we have currently available for those projects include $2 million from LCCMR, which we will be directing towards five of the projects in southeastern Minnesota. In addition, we have a $3 million bonding appropriation, as well as two federal appropriations totaling $7 million. So approximately $12 million available for those 77,000 acres. And again, we have not acquired the values yet, so we're not sure if the funds available are sufficient and whether or not we would need to apply through the LOHC for additional funding.
Thank you. Senator Saxog.
One quick question for Mr. Peterson, Madam Chair. So, and but in terms of projects of this magnitude and this uniqueness, we don't really have anything even in potential in the future, do we, in terms of size?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
Senator, this will certainly be the singular project of that magnitude. Again, the 76,000-acre project in Coochaching County is not comparable, but in that almost approximate size class. So they're very large landscape scale, I guess, projects as opposed to small parcel projects.
And Madam Chair, even that 76,000-acre parcel is in, if you know where Coochaching County, it's north of Itasca County, it's north of what we're seeing here, and it really doesn't, when you talk about the development and the potential development, it just doesn't have what this one does because of the closeness to population centers and the like.
Madam Chair, Senator, obviously closer to population centers creates a much higher risk of development, of parcelization, of splitting off 40s, 80s for hunting cabins and so on. So totally, and that is obviously accounted for in the appraisal process where they look at highest and best use.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator, are there any houses in this 187,000 acres?
Madam Chair, I guess I couldn't tell you exactly, but there are, in some cases, townships that these parcels are part of, and there's farms or cabins that surround them. They aren't obviously. What makes this so valuable is, as you can see, it's pretty much contiguous. And as we said, this continues to pay property taxes. And we've had a few inkles from up north where people have said, I think my taxes may go up because I'm going to have 30,000 acres in my backyard and it's never going to be developed.
And how are you going to answer that, Senator?
God bless you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else that has anything to add? Thank you. We will consider these comments very carefully as we proceed along. The next thing where people have spoken out and said, oh my gosh, you're trying to do away. We're not going to have brown trout. We're not going to have rainbow trout. We're not going to, oh my gosh, you're trying to stop it. And that's not quite what we were trying to do. We better talk about how we can clarify ecology and habitat. Our language on Article 5, I've got a letter from addressing this from the Trout Unlimited, Mr. Lencheski, from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
I want to make a comment about this.
And Ms. Stark wrote about this, and several other people did. And so we're saying, okay, our hands are up. We're not trying to deceive. We're trying to, right now, need some suggestions for clarification. And I know somebody here is from the DNR, too. I don't know.
Maybe you know.
It's a different person than Mr. Peterson, isn't it? Mr. Meyer, Commissioner? I know the Commissioner wrote me a letter, and Ms. Virginia's a letter. I think he copied everybody. In fact, he wrote a letter on May 5th and on May 12th.
Madam Chair, we've been writing a lot of letters. So. Just for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And thank you for allowing us a few minutes just to briefly talk about this. I believe the language that you're speaking of is in Article 5. Just trying to find it here really quickly. Subdivision 9.
Section 11, subdivision.
Page 103 and 104, where we were talking about proposal and project requirements. You can see there, beginning on 80.23, says lands acquired by fee, restored or protected by easements with money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund should ensure the viability of Minnesota's forests, prairies, wetlands, and habitats by supporting native biological diversity and their ecological complexes and provide protection against invasive species and must meet one or more of the following criteria. And then there are seven criteria listed. Identified as an area of biodiversity, maintain or enhance native plant, fish, or wildlife species designated as endangered or threatened, possess a unique quality that is of value to the biodiversity of the region, are adjacent to lands meeting one or more of the requirements under clauses 1 through 4 that when restored or protected enhance those adjacent lands, are degraded that when restored would provide or contribute to critical habitat for native plants, fish, wildlife, or enhance native plants, fish, or wildlife species. And I've had many conversations about this in the past several days with Representative Wagenius and other folks. This section, the way we're looking at it and reading it, says in C up above, 80.26 specifically, must meet one or more of the following criteria. So lands acquired by fee with these dollars, if it met the criteria on 80.30, saying maintain or enhance native fish, plant, or wildlife species designated as endangered or threatened, or if it met the requirement, because again it says must meet one or more of the following criteria. If it just met the requirement that it enhance native plant, fish, or wildlife species, it would focus at that level. So that would be eligible. Our concerns is that the Constitution focuses on habitat for game and fish. By focusing on the species, this may not let us do an acquisition for the best wildlife habitat. And I'd like to have Director Shad from our Fish and Wildlife Division just speak briefly about acquisitions that we're looking to do that would support the duck plan or the pheasant plan or the rough grouse plan, and how this may come in conflict with that concept. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Shad, welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Shad, Director of the Fish and Wildlife Division for DNR. And I have testified on some of our concerns with the language in Article 5 in front of Representative Murphy's committee on several occasions. And I think you can see from the letters that you've gotten from some of the organizations here that this language has really created some hardening of the lines between folks that support habitat work and folks that support biodiversity issues. In some ways, it's kind of reminiscent of some of the debates that I was aware of very early in my career. Since then, I think fish and wildlife habitat practitioners and ecologists have recognized that they really need to work together to figure out how we're going to manage these natural systems to protect and restore them in the face of things like development and wetland loss, climate change, and so forth. And so the two professions have come together and developed some joint approaches to restore and protect habitat that address both habitat and biodiversity needs. I think our concern here is that this language, by being as prescriptive as it is and as limiting as it is kind of driving some of those collaborative approaches apart. And I can give you a number of examples of where we increasingly are moving to this more united approach to addressing habitat and biodiversity at the same time. A very good example and a really obvious example is the fact that the lion's share of native prairie that's been preserved in this state resides on wildlife management areas, many of which have been used primarily to protect and enhance habitat for pheasants, technically a non-native species, and waterfowl and other species of interest to sportsmen. Many of the forest management practices, including clear cuts that we do to enhance habitat for ruffed grouse and other early successional species, incorporates things like legacy areas or leave areas, where we leave patches of unharvested timber to mimic natural disturbance patterns and kind of the natural ecology of some of these forest systems. The plantings that we're doing for shoreline restoration, for forest reforestation, for prairie restoration, almost exclusively use native species, and increasingly we're considering the genetic origin of those plants in our planting efforts. A lot of the forest habitat work and the silvicultural approaches that we take now are based on ecological classification and the native plant community classifications that our ecologists have developed are driving the kinds of approaches that we're taking to manage wildlife habitat and to produce timber on those lands. And so I think the practitioners and the managers in our agencies, many experts in the conservation organizations that we partner with on a day-to-day basis, and the scientific community are figuring this out. They understand that we need to consider both. They're developing ways to do both with the same dollars. Our concern again is that the level of detail in this House language, and the difficulty that we've had in interpreting this language and figuring out whether we can or cannot do some of these commonly accepted practices, given some of the limitations in this language, are really going to kind of force us to go our own way again and have the restoration people kind of working in one camp and the habitat people working in another camp.
Okay, Mr. Senator Cohen.
Well, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I can ask you a couple questions, and maybe Representative Wilgenius as well. Obviously, in the Senate, we don't have anything like this. I just asked Senator Frederickson. I'm kind of outvoted on the Senate side by four members of Senator Anderson's division, which I don't serve on. So, but I understand from Senator Frederickson, this issue was not discussed in Senator Anderson's division. So, first of all, Mr. Chair, you used a phrase, technically not a native species. What's technically not, or... Can you just define that for me?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chair.
Ringneck pheasants were introduced to Minnesota in the early 20th century. They've since become naturalized, and they're generally regarded as non-harmful, but they weren't native to Minnesota, and certainly folks enjoy them and view them as a very positive thing out on the landscape, but technically, they're not a native species.
Okay, well, then just to follow up then on a couple of questions. I'm not trying to be facetious, but at some point, would a species be grandfathered in as a native species, or if the species has been around for 100 years or so? Again, I'm just, like I said, don't mean to be facetious, but trying to figure out when a species becomes native or doesn't become native. And maybe somebody from the House could answer.
No,
that's it.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, you know, there are a number of species like pheasants. Brown trout, for example, are very common in a lot of our cold water streams in the southeast and the northeast. Steelhead, for example, along the North Shore. They're you know, again, technically non-native. They've become established. They've been very successful, and they don't seem to be unduly harming other resources. But based on the language in the House bill here, we would not consider those native. We certainly wouldn't consider them harmful, and we certainly devote significant resources to managing those species. But under all commonly accepted definitions, they would be considered non-native.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, just finally then, maybe this question is directed toward House members. How would that be implemented? I mean, if hypothetically, the Heritage Commission comes up with a proposal, let's use pheasants. Mr. Chad's indicated that's
technically not a native species. So if the Heritage Commission's come up with a proposal that involves habitat involving, I don't know, ring-tailed pheasants, whatever, as a legislature then, do we step in and say, you can't do it because that's not a native species? How is that handled in the context of the legislative work?
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. I think these conversations are actually very helpful that we're having, even though it's been by letter and rather than sit-down conversations and around a table like this. One of the interesting things about pheasants is that science tells us right now, good current science says that if given a choice, a pheasant would prefer a native prairie for nesting and for living. So that's good because our Constitution talks about protecting native prairies. So in a sense, we can see a win-win. And similar for trout, if you're protecting an aquatic area for natives, then the non-natives are going to be happy too. But I think just to get to some of the discussion that the language has brought up, I mean, I think I'm seeing the path to being more helpful to everybody. And one of the things I think we've got to think about is that the Constitution actually tells us that there are four things we've got to do. One is to protect, restore, and enhance prairies. One is to protect, restore, and enhance wetlands. One is to protect, restore, and enhance forest. And one is to protect, restore, and enhance habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. So part of this language is designed to help protect forests, protect prairie, protect wetlands. So when you get to the other part for protecting habitat, that needs to be fleshed out. And I think that's exactly right. So I look at one of the lines, like line six, where people are going, oh, no, we don't want to protect pheasants or brown trout. That's just not true. Folks want habitat for pheasants and brown trout. So then I think more language like our degraded lands that when restored as prairies, forest, or wetlands would provide or contribute to critical habitat, not for native plants, because we've addressed that above, but for game and wildlife. So there's different ways we can approach this language, I think, to make everybody to address all four of the habitats that we're talking about. And similarly, I think when we were in committee, we added line seven at the suggestion of one of the Outdoor Heritage Council members, but that didn't seem to work, and I think that probably needs to be rewritten. And it's a reasonably easy thing to do with good minds. We can do that.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, no, there are other senators who had questions. So but again, I understand what you were saying, Representative Wagenius, in terms of working with your language. I mean, the difficulty we have is, obviously, if you look at the side-by-sides, we have a lot of blank pages on the right-hand side. And so I'm wondering just in terms of how it would work. And again, I arbitrarily think, since we're talking about native species, as to just how you would see the governance section working in terms of the relationship between the Heritage Commission and the legislature, if, again, there is a recommendation, a proposal within the Heritage Commission that doesn't look at native species. And do we make that determination if it's a native species? Do we? That's what I'm just trying to wonder in terms of step by step how we would operate.
Representative Genius.
I think what the House was attempting to do was look forward, not currently, but to look forward and say, how do we support the constitutional language with statute that works? And having these discussions will make sure that we are supporting the Constitution with language that works. Because what we're trying to do is provide guidelines for a long time that will give to Minnesotans exactly what they voted for. And I think that all of us want to do that. We see the language, we know what Minnesotans voted for, and we want to make sure that Minnesotans are getting what they think they're getting. And so good minds will come together and we'll work that out.
It is certainly wasn't the intent of the House to drive what Mr. Shad said, to drive people that had come together before apart. That certainly isn't what our goal was. We're trying to bring people together more with common goals. And we did invite people along the way in the committee to offer suggestions and to tell us what they liked, not just throw the thing out.
And Madam Chair, certainly some of that comes across, you know, when I read the House language. So let me just now take it to an extreme. Let's say there's a proposal from the Lessard Commission that they want to establish a habitat. And what it's going to be in southern Minnesota, we're going to have a game preserve set up of lions. And we're going to be able to do some big game hunting of lions. Okay, that clearly is not a native species to Minnesota. So, again, I'm trying to figure out, separate from what you suggest, in terms of the language within this section, would we then step in and say, no, just a second, lions are not native to Minnesota. You can't do that. And that's wondering where the dividing line is or how the operation of this section works in the context of a legislative session, if that helps at all.
Well, I think, Senator, it does, and I think your grandfathering was good because we don't have lions walking around in southern Minnesota. That wouldn't happen then. But we do have brown trout swimming up the streams and that other kind of rainbow trout. And we have pheasants walking along the sides of the roads in some cases, and so we know that they're here.
To be fair, not the roads in my district.
That's too bad, Senator. Senator Fredericks.
Madam Chair and members, Senator Cohen asked me if we had considered language like this in the Senate, and I answered we have not, but I wanted to make clear that in Senator Chaudhry's committee and Senator Anderson's, we certainly spent a lot of time over the years talking about biodiversity, maintaining or enhancing native plant, fish, or wildlife species, maintaining native ecological communities, unique qualities of biodiversity. We've discussed all of that, and we certainly, I think, as a consensus, support that. But the differences I see between the House and the Senate is how we'd achieve that. I see the House as being very prescriptive language, with before something be considered, they shall consider these things. I think in the Senate we looked at the makeup of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, and for the public members, they have to have practical experience or expertise or demonstrated knowledge in the science, policy, or practice of restoring, protecting, and enhancing wetlands, prairies, forests, habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And we have four legislators sit on that. I think we were more trusting that they would look at the issues that are identified in the House language and we talk about in the Senate, and we'd expect them to use the good judgment to consider those when they decide which projects to recommend to the full legislature, and that there would be a good common exchange of information among the four legislators that we have in that council and the scientific and practical folks that we have as citizens. So I think it's a difference of approach. And I think the Senate would prefer to trust the good judgment of the folks that are on the Outdoor Heritage Council and then look at the recommendations they bring to us rather than being prescriptive on the front end.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for Mr. Shadd. Your comment about being reminded of old battles within the scientific community, something that stuck with me. I guess my specific question is, in the interest of time, have you seen this type of language before being used? And you'd said that scientific communities don't normally use this approach anymore. Is this language that was used in during a past day in the scientific world? I was wondering if you could shed some light on how this, if you've seen this language before, if it's familiar in your old days, not old days, but past days of management practice.
Mr. Shadd.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, it's feeling like old days, but I haven't seen language like this, but I think if you look at kind of the evolution of some of our conservation programs over time, we fund the Scientific and Natural Areas Program, and that's our biodiversity program, and we fund our Wildlife Management Area Program, and that's our habitat program, and I think increasingly, we still have those vestiges, and those are still very important. It's important to have that range of conservation lands out there, but I think we're also recognizing that kind of collectively, in our desire to achieve both wildlife habitat and biodiversity goals in the state, we can't just do biodiversity on our scientific and natural areas land, and we need to look at our entire land base to manage fish and wildlife habitat and populations. So it's been an evolution of thinking that isn't necessarily reflected in some of our programs and our approaches out there.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So then just turning just to the biodiversity approach, maybe in a scientific natural area context, would this be typical, a typical approach you'd see even if one's goal was only biodiversity, would this be typical language or a typical approach for a scientific, an SNA, for example, or something else?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I think the language does a better job of ensuring that the dollars are spent in ways that manage for some of those biodiversity elements and kind of misses the fact that an awful lot of the work we do, whether we're buying and restoring land or managing existing public lands, for example, is done for a very specific purpose or for multiple purposes and multiple uses. And it's a very valid conservation approach. And increasingly, again, I'll just reiterate, we're doing that management, doing that enhancement to benefit wildlife in a way that it also addresses some of those biodiversity issues. Our concern is that this language doesn't allow for that side of the flexibility and is too limiting to really allow some of those wildlife practices to occur.
Mr. Chair, I would just note that the constitutional provision is, particularly for this fund, the habitat fund, it's habitat. That's what this portion of the fund is for, and it's very clear in the Constitution. There's discussion, of course, prairies and such and wetlands, and that's important. But the constitutional provision is explicit that we are looking for habitat, our first goal.
Senator Chaudhry, we had a lot of discussions on the House side on just that issue, and I believe it's quite clearly that it's prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat. And I wouldn't deign to put any one of those above any of the rest. I think the constitutional language is clear that it's prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, Mr. Shad. It looks like the concerns are primarily about the adjectives that are involved here in definitions. And we've been talking about established or naturalized species that are primarily game species. But over the last few years, we've also been dealing here as a legislature with invasives and exotics. And I think that there's probably a clear, I would hope there's a clear consensus that we want to try to discourage those invasives and exotics. We've passed legislation on trying to even have reporting, like if red deer are escaped or released from a game farm, or if Asian carp are caught, we have to report those. If I think you're currently struggling with hogs or somewhere, in other states we have the Eurasian wild boar that's been released and is causing havoc. So I think the challenge here, if we're going to provide goalposts or at least some bumpers in terms of where dollars go, how do we separate out or define or encourage our current situation, whether it's native or established plants and animals and in the prairies, wetlands, and forests, but try to discourage those invasives or exotics. And we haven't even talked about the micro, you know, the New Zealand mud snail or those type of things. And as we spend millions of dollars over the next, hundreds of millions of dollars over the next 25 years, how do we look at unintended consequences? How do we try to not have another buckthorn problem with what we're doing? And that's, I think, what our challenge is in trying to define this. And I think that's a goal that both houses of the legislature and the executive branch would share.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you, Representative Hansen. That is exactly what we're trying to do. And every day at the Department of Natural Resources, we have invasive species training for all of our field staff, terrestrial and aquatic. The work that we've been able to do with the legislature on the transporting of fish, bait fish, water. It's illegal to transport water in your minnow bucket or water in your live well right now or in your bilge of your boat. So we have a lot of things that we've been doing. But we need to make sure that we do that in a systematic way throughout the expenditure of all of these funds. And members, don't get me wrong, or don't get the commissioner's letter wrong. It's not that we don't support the concepts that are in the House language. Our concern is that it's a lot there to try to digest and make sure we're doing right at this point in time. We feel we need to spend more time as a group, as a legislator, executive branch, stakeholder committee to develop these guiding principles to get it right and make sure that we are laying the solid foundation for the spending of these dollars for the next 25 years. I'm reminded of the work that the Legislative Citizen Commission did the first year that they were reformed. They spent a lot of time trying to figure out how they're supposed to be. They came back and they did the tried and true projects. They've come back every year since then and have refined their mission. I think it's important for us to accept the work of the council that the Lasard Heritage Council has done, with the Clean Water Council, the Parks and Trails groups, all of the people have been working on this, and get the money going, but spend some more time and really figure out the governance pieces. What are the practices that we need to have in place? You all should have a copy of a letter that Commissioner Holson sent to the committee last night. We focus a lot on the governance pieces. We don't say that we don't want any governance. Our main focus on those two pages of issues is we need to spend the time and make sure the governance that we place, the procedures we put in place, are the correct things to do and that they're done the right way the first time, rather than to come back every year and try to deal with these things. So we're trying to figure out the best way to do this. I think the best way to do it is to spend a little bit more time and figure out what all these sections should be and what they should say, but also look at the experts who've given us a lot of recommendations to get this money on the ground in the right way this first year.
It's almost like a speech that I gave a few weeks ago, isn't it?
I think I've heard some of that somewhere.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard Senator Cohen ask a few minutes ago if there was a Senate position on any of this language, and I just wanted to clarify that I was the author of this bill in the Senate. and Representative Wagenius and I wrote it together. It didn't receive a hearing in the Senate. It didn't move forward. Just a very few of the ideas from the bill ended up in our bill, the website, the signage, and the 25-year plan are pretty much the only pieces that remain that were proposed originally in the oversight bill. And I guess the discussion that we had early on was there's a difference between respecting the work of the council and the allocations that the council has recommended in the case of the habitat portion. And you can do that, and you can still have set a long-term vision of what we as legislators believe the policy of the state is in terms of interpreting the language of the Constitution and setting some standards in law. And so that was the intention that I had in introducing the bill. But those are really two different issues, and that's our responsibility. And, you know, the membership of the council will change over time, but we need to make sure that the legislature establishes what the standard should be over time.
And clarification, Senator Anderson, your bill was not heard, so your bill did not get assigned to your committee. It got assigned to another committee.
No, it was in the policy committee.
I see. Rep. Sam Wagenius. Okay. Commissioner, when you spoke first, were you saying that the department didn't want to make mistakes, you wanted to get the money out the first year, you didn't want to make any mistakes, then were you saying that there's no place in the policy making for the governance, for the legislative input, and that the department will do it?
Madam
or were
Chair.
You saying what was said earlier by Senator Fredrickson, that have trust in the people that have been appointed to the council?
Madam Chair, members, it's somewhat of the latter. If you look at the parks language, and there's several places in the overall bill that establish 10-year strategic plans, 25-year strategic plans, and processes. I think that these kind of guiding principles should be established perhaps through some type of more open type process, rather than to have this be debated in the legislative arena where we haven't had perhaps enough time to fully vet all of the issues that are out there. I know part of the department's problem was we didn't have time to engage in the House on these issues early enough because we were focused on budget issues and a lot of things on that level. So when it came up in the policy committee, passed the policy committee, went to the finance committee, that's when we started engaging. But it's because we were busy doing other things. We should have been engaged in this earlier. I don't know if we would have changed anything right now because it is very complex. We have, you know, as Director Shad said, there's disagreements among the scientific community and amongst our own scientists about some of these concepts right now. So it's very complex for us to try to deal with at this point in time.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Let's kind of get back to one of the basics here. And one of the basics in some of the language that, as we talk about the House language, are outcomes and measuring outcomes and evaluating results. Is there any disagreement about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, no.
Commissioner.
And I believe I said that in the beginning of my remarks.
So that concept is strong and good. So as we go forward, there's no disagreement there.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner.
Representative Wagenius, not at all. It's we have to do that. What we're concerned about is some of the language and the principles that are established dealing with systematic restoration, ecological restoration, and adaptive management that we need to make sure that we're dealing with. Restoration plans on all acquired lands when the intent of purchasing a piece of property may not be to restore it, but to be to protect it. But yes, the peace and the good, going back to that section, Article 5 again, it requires all lands purchased to have an ecological restoration plan. The intent of an acquisition may not be for an ecological restoration, but to protect the land that's there. So it's just some of those things we feel we need more time to fully vet.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I understand that. That was a good critique, and I totally understand that. And that's a drafting error. We should change that. When the governor wrote a letter to us, he said to us that we should accept the Outdoor Heritage Council in all of its. Their riders there, and the governor said accept it because it's scientific. Their riders there, would you, in your critique, are you excluding or the riders done by the Outdoor Heritage Council? Or if we were to or to put it another way, if we followed the riders done by the Outdoor Heritage Council, would that be okay?
Madam Chair, members, and again, I refer to the letter from Commissioner Holston. Focusing those comments that I speak on, that I've been focusing on, are specifically on Article 5. I would have to go through rider by rider to address those specific issues.
Representative Guinness.
I'm talking about where Article 5 and the Outdoor Heritage Council are totally consistent. Would you support those provisions, or are you saying reject those right now, too, and give those more time?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Guinness. I need to go back and take a more detailed, in-depth look at all those riders before I give you an answer of that magnitude right now.
Representative Guinness.
So let me get this straight. The governor is supporting the Outdoor Heritage Council, but DNR is not?
Madam Chair, members.
Commissioner.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm just not going to commit myself on record for something that I'm not comfortable with saying right now. So I can get back to the committee on that, Madam Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple specific questions for Mr. Shedd. I'm presuming that the Subdivision 9 proposal and project requirements would apply to all projects that come out of this fund, whether it's for habitat or biodiversity areas or wetlands. The question I have for you, Mr. Shad, is if there is a proposal to restore, protect, or enhance habitat, which is in the constitutional provision, is it necessary to establish a reserve habitat to support native biological diversity and ecological complexes, as well as protecting against invasive species in order to protect, preserve, or enhance habitat?
Mr. Shad.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I'm not sure if this gets at your question, but I think there are some acquisition projects that we would commonly do that would have difficulty meeting any of these seven criteria. If for example, we had a pheasant project proposed and it also had a rare plant community, a native prairie on it or something like that, we would certainly give it a higher priority. It would kind of rise to the top of our priority list. And again, if we can achieve multiple conservation values on the same piece of property, that's a very common sense thing to do, and we're doing that more and more. But that's not the case for all of our lands. And there's certainly lands that we acquire or restore or enhance that have limited wildlife habitat value, but might have very significant biodiversity values. They might have a rare species on them, for example. And there are other lands that we manage very intensively for some game populations, for example, and for some hunting recreational opportunities that have pretty limited biodiversity. There's a whole range of values out there, and I think it's important that the language allows for all of those opportunities to be considered as we look at projects.
My question is, Chair, is it necessary? It's preferable to have those. Is it necessary for a habitat project to support native biological diversity and ecological complex and protect against a native invasive species at the same time?
Mr. Shad.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, it's not necessary. It's certainly desirable.
Then, Madam Chair, Mr. Shad, is it, when you're restoring habitat, is it necessary that that habitat be in an area of biodiversity significance identified by the County Biological Survey?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, again, if it was, it would certainly get a higher priority than if it wasn't. But that's certainly not the case, and a parcel of land could provide very significant wildlife habitat values without meeting that criterion.
Madam Chair,
Senator Chaudhry,
is it when you're preserving, enhancing, or protecting habitat, is it necessary to consider whether there are endangered or threatened species on it, whether it be native plant, fish, or wildlife?
Mr. Shad.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, we'd certainly consider that again, but if it lacked those rare or endangered species, that wouldn't disqualify it from a habitat investment.
So, Madam Chair, just to avoid repetition, I would just kind of incorporate the same questions that I had Mr. Shad on these requirements on to the rest of the requirements, and I think people can probably extrapolate that most, if not all, of the rest of these requirements are not necessary, at least for the restoring habitat, and even in some biodiversity projects, perhaps these are. To have all of these requirements together in one piece would inhibit those projects as well. Point made.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shad, when we, you mentioned earlier doing a pheasant project. When we're doing a pheasant project, we're not buying pheasant, are we? Madam Chair. I assume that pheasant, even though they are a non-native species, share an ecosystem with other native species. I would also assume that they are part of a biodiversity of that ecosystem. If they are in an ecosystem with native species, they are a non-native species, that is a biodiversity. More than one species, I would suppose, could be described as biodiversity. So my question is, of these seven criteria on this sheet that Senator Chaudhry helped us by abbreviating his questions on, if only one of those has to be met, and there is nothing restricting us from restoring or protecting or enhancing prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat, as long as there are native species involved in the ecosystem, what I can't figure out is how does that affect what we do with pheasants? How does that impact brown trout and rainbow trout? And that's what I just can't understand. When I've gotten this feedback, Mr. Shad, from groups out there saying, oh, my gosh, you're destroying what trout fishermen love to do, and I honestly don't get it, because unless the only thing in that stream is the brown trout, there's nothing in this language that would exclude that stream from restoration, enhancement, or protection. Is there something I'm missing, Mr. Schatt?
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, I think with this language, groups such as Pheasants Forever or Trout Unlimited or the Department for that matter could do most of the work that we typically do. But I think we'd be doing it under kind of dishonest premises. And by that I mean if Pheasants Forever wanted to do some work for the benefit of pheasants and pheasant hunters, under this criteria they would have to write their proposal and kind of work around the pheasant issue and say, well, what we really want to do is a prairie project that includes various elements that benefit pheasants without really saying they want to do a project for pheasants. And the same would be true for a trout project. And I think if it's our intent to allow those kinds of projects and practices to be funded here with this source of funding, I think we shouldn't force folks to kind of work around the language to do what we all agree they should be able to do. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Lanchesky. Mr. Lanchesky, I received your letter, and I found that it was very helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, I am John Lanchesky. I'm the chair of the Minnesota Council of Trout Unlimited, and thank you for that comment. It's been very good to hear the exchange here, and, I guess I'd echo Mr. Schatt in that there clearly is what we're trying to avoid is confusion on the part of the public officials, the agencies. I mean, I think most people would agree what we propose to do to restore habitat that can be utilized by a non-native but well-established naturalized species, that's a good thing, and it's sort of what voters intended would be the money would be used for. But I think the language, it creates some confusion, and it's precisely that. We want to be honest about what we're doing, and there not be any doubt that this is permitted under the laws. And so it's really to, again, I think there's a fair amount of confusion, or there wouldn't be so many letters and people getting so worked up. I think it's a little confusing. Clearly, the intentions were good. I just think it's got to be worked on a little bit. And I guess we would favor stepping back and making sure all these provisions are well thought out. And it certainly is the province of the legislature to look at these governance issues. I don't think it's strictly the Lessard Council that gets to decide the governance issues. I think that's your job. And I just think that we haven't had quite enough time to go through that. And that's what we're looking for. So it's very encouraging to hear this discussion. I guess I'll stand for questions. I don't really have any other comments.
And Mr. Lanchesky, you represent Trout Unlimited.
Trout Unlimited, yes.
Is that brown trout and rainbow trout?
brown trout, rainbow trout, brook trout, and lake trout are two native species, brook trout and lake trout. But
they need cold water, right?
They all need cold water, and our native trout are actually chars, and they need very cold water. And that's where the problem is, that we've done a pretty good job of degrading our watersheds to where the point where we can't have native trout where we used to.
Yep.
So we work for the day when we can again, but in the interim, nothing energizes conservationists like a productive fishery to focus our attention.
And we need lots of trees around the water.
Absolutely.
For the shade, to make sure that the coolness doesn't escape.
Especially in northern Minnesota. It's very important to have a northern forest. That's what gives us our northern trout streams.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think that's all on my list for the ecology and habitat, but we've also asked Mr. Lish here from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because we have gotten some letters saying that, well, some letters trying to clear our minds on the Fish and Wildlife Service and R4. What page?
Four.
Page 4. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. In our committee, at the very first meeting, as we went over this proposal, it's about the tall grass prairie, and that it said land was to be purchased. I think it's land was to be purchased for the federal government, and the federal government would buy. Use that money or to help us out, and the federal government would own the land in the end. Was that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. For the record, my name is Jim Leach. I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Minnesota, and I supervise national wildlife refuges and wetland management districts in Minnesota. And the proposal that we submitted to the Lasard Arto Heritage Council was for the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. We are one of the two public agencies in Minnesota that hold a significant amount of land in prairie and wetland, Minnesota DNR being the primary agency that holds land in these types of habitats, grasslands, and wetlands. But we have this Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge, and we're acquiring lands annually. We get appropriations of about $500,000 from the U.S. Congress to acquire lands in fee title, where we own them directly, or purchase easements, perpetual easements from willing landowners. And we have been doing that for the last 7 years and have acquired almost 5,000 acres in Minnesota to date.
That the federal government owns.
That is correct.
And in my area, sometimes people bristle at the idea that the federal government should own more lands up there. What would be the advantage to Minnesotans, all Minnesotans, to have this ownership in the federal government's hands?
Madam Chair, I believe there's a number of things that benefit the state of Minnesota and its citizens with respect to the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. The matching dollars that the Fish and Wildlife Service brings to the table for prairie acquisition, our expertise in management and restoration of grasslands in the state, public access to those lands for recreational purposes. In addition to that, the long-term management and protection of our fee and easements lands are done by the Fish and Wildlife Service. We annually fly our lands and document encroachments on those lands, both fee and easement. So we do take care of our easements and fee lands. And lastly, I think another significant point, if they are retained in federal ownership, Fish and Wildlife Service pays to the counties refuge revenue sharing and alleviates that cost on the state for pilt payments to the counties.
Explain how that works, please, Mr. Leach.
Madam Chair, in general, I can speak to the refuge revenue sharing. If you or this body would like specifics on refuge revenue sharing, I can get our realty staff to provide a succinct description of how we do it on a project-by-project basis. But in general,
as we acquire the land from willing landowners, we pay a payment, obviously, to that landowner. In addition to that payment, some percentage of the actual value that we've agreed on with that landowner, we pay a percentage of that to the county to be used to offset the loss of taxes from the private citizens. So refuge revenue sharing are payments from the federal government to the counties for the lands that we as a federal agency hold within the county.
Would our school trust lands be helped, our school trust fund be helped if this land was, if we allowed this land to be purchased by the, or purchased this land and the federal fish and game manage it? Or doesn't that have any connection with our school trust lands?
Madam Chair, that's an area of outside of my area of expertise, and I would be hesitant to comment. I don't believe trust fund lands would benefit. But again, it's outside my area of expertise, so I probably should not get myself deeper into trouble.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I think we'd have to swap land. I don't think we could sell them the land. That's a question for maybe Mr. Knopf. But I have a question for Mr. Leach. What counties are involved with the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge?
Madam Chair, Senator, all of the western counties in Minnesota would be eligible for Northern Tallgrass acquisition. I think there are 44 counties, if memory serves me right, that were identified in our EIS that we produced about 8 years ago that identifies which counties and which geographic areas. All of the biological county areas that have identified existing native prairie are included within that area.
Madam Chair, Mr. Leach, just as a geographical reference point, would they go down as far as like Traverse County and Big Stone County?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, it would stretch from northwestern Minnesota all the way down to the southern border of Iowa, where we could acquire fee or easement interest from willing landowners.
Madam Chair, just an observation. I know many of those counties have a very low percentage of their land in government ownership. Like some of the counties in my district are less than 1% of the land area is in public ownership, the reverse of your part of the state.
And so it would be okay?
It would generally be okay as long as there's some benefit to as long as the taxpayers get some property tax payment off those lands, which they would.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm from the southeast, and just because we have a low percentage of land owned by the federal government doesn't mean we want any more there. This is a very concerning point to me here. I mean, we're collecting money from our taxpayers as Minnesotans so that we can buy land and give it to the federal government. That just doesn't make any sense to me, Madam Chair. There's quite a disconnect there for me that the last thing that the constituents I represent want is to take their dollars and put more money into federal land ownership. That makes absolutely no sense to me. But I'm just a poor farm boy from Fillmore County, so.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I hate to say I'm just a city girl, but.
But you are.
But I am. And I can tell you that the discussion within the Heritage Council, the Lessard Heritage Council, about this issue, we did raise, especially Representative Hansen and I, raised the issue of built liability for the state. And so, you know, Mr. Leach has really laid out the advantages that we saw, that if we're going to protect this land, having it be in federal ownership avoided future liability for PILT for the state. It avoided future management costs for the state. And it allowed us to achieve matching dollars. So it really was a good fiscal decision in our mind to have some of the land be acquired by the federal government for those reasons.
Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, you know in our caucus, the minority caucus in the House, that we've seen amendment after amendment where we want to sell state-owned land, farmland, and so forth, and get less land in government ownership, whether it's state or federal. So there may be some, I mean, I'll listen to the conversation, sure. But I have some great concerns there.
Two amendments on the floor just today that would have done that. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Leach, I want to go to the property and the issues here in terms of identifying property where we have native prairie. I think from looking back to my career in the in the state agency, there were programs to kind of identify where western prairie fringed orchid was, and we have those things identified where endangered or threatened species are. And there have been a number of efforts to try to quantify exactly how many tracts of native prairie are out there. And then you have to overlay how many have willing sellers. And then the availability of the money to make the purchase. So when you talk about the availability of the property, do you have willing sellers, and are those tracts high-valued tracts that could be purchased with the dollars coming quickly?
Mr. Leach.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, I will start out with the biological focus of our acquisition program. The Fish and Wildlife Service is a very much biologically oriented agency, federal agency. We are responsible for migratory birds, threatened or endangered species, and certain interjurisdictional fish. And in so doing, we use biology and base our decisions on land acquisition based on biology. So the County Biological Survey has been very valuable at documenting where the remnant tracts of native prairie in this state are. I was just recently, Monday and Tuesday of this week, up in northwestern Minnesota at TNC's Glacial Ridge area. That part of that is Glacial Ridge National Wildlife Refuge. The Nature Conservancy and the Fish and Wildlife Service have partnered to protect the largest existing population of prairie fringed orchids, which is a threatened or endangered species federally. And it is the largest tall grass prairie restoration in this country. By mentioning this, I'm getting again to the biological focus. We use whatever tools are available, be they the County Biological Survey, our land GIS landscape level planning efforts up at our Fergus Falls office to document where these tracts are, and then geographically focus our acquisitions into areas with the highest concentration of existing remnant prairie. To get to your final question about the willing landowners, we annually have more willing landowners than we have dollars available for. One of the federal legislators, one of their staff, have recently asked, how much could you spend on northern tallgrass in Minnesota? And conservatively, I told her, the staffer, that we could spend $2 million on fee and easement on northern tallgrass from willing sellers in Minnesota. We currently have a backlog of willing landowners, and if these dollars are appropriated through this body, we would be able to spend them on high priority acquisitions involving remnant prairie and be able to restore converted prairie adjacent to those remnant tracts.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
I'm going to follow up on the question of ownership, and I think House members are somewhat sensitive to that, because we do have hours and hours and hours of debate about ownership and built and ownership and selling state-owned land and
easements.
Is there any history or we have issues in my county with sprawl where things may be sold down the line because sprawl encroaches around a property. These areas that may be less likely, but is there any precedent where, let's say, if the federal government ever did want to vacate the property or transfer the property or walk away from the property, that it would revert back to the state
if the state provided the investment. Is that in Minnesota or in other states? Is there any history to that or any precedent that you could look for?
Mr. Leach.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the Senate version of this bill, there's a language that would be considered a reversionary clause. If the owner of the land, mismanager, wanted to divest interest in that land, the land would revert back to the state government or the state. So I think that would be protected. The frequency with which the Fish and Wildlife Service divests lands of the National Wildlife Refuge System, we have to take that to Congress, the U.S. Congress, before we can divest land outside of the National Wildlife Refuge System. So the frequency that with which we do that is extremely remote.
Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Wiginius, I'm sorry.
Just a real quick question. I may have missed it. How many acres do you have of Tallgrass Prairie in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative Wiginius, we currently have approximately between 4,500 and 5,000 acres stretched between fee and easement in western Minnesota.
And how much of that would be in fee?
Of the 4,500 to 5,000 acres, about two-thirds of that is fee, and the remaining is easement. All fee acres are open for public recreation.
And finally, you said you had kind of $2 million worth sitting out there. How many acres would that be?
Again, Madam Chair, Representative, depending on the percentage of fee versus easement, it could vary from 500 acres to potentially 1,500 acres, again, depending on the percentage of fee versus easement.
No, just rough. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McCormick, item three.
Madam Chair, do you want to have the fiscal analyst run through the spreadsheet first, or would you prefer to have us run through language first?
Madam Chair, our fiscal analyst had to leave, so we're wondering if we could start with the language.
I think we pretty much know the spreadsheet, actually.
Madam Chair.
I would just soon start with the language.
Okay, Madam Chair, on our side, Janelle Taylor is going to run through Articles 1, 2, and 3.
Thank you.
The ritual reading of the side-by-side.
Madam Chair, members, as Mr. McCormick stated, we're going to start with Article 1, and this would be the Outdoor Heritage Fund recommendations. And I'm just going to highlight the differences from the Outdoor Heritage Council recommendations and highlight any differences that either the Senate can go through their differences and the House can go through their differences from the recommended language. And on ARF1, the only real difference besides the money is the Senate states that the appropriations in the article are one time. Ours are intended to and are only in the first year, so I see it as a technical difference. Moving on to page R2, the language is identical except for the House adds some additional language requiring that native prairie restorations use vegetation and seed of native origin. This is language you'll see throughout the House position and in other House sides, including the bonding bill.
Madam Chair, can I just make a comment on that? The House, you'll see a number of places like this on 2.19 to 2.28 on the House side where they've added the language to specific projects. Both the House and the Senate have similar language that apply to all projects, so the Senate didn't see a need to put it for specific projects. Rather, we have language later on that you'll see that applies to all projects. And it's basically the same language that the House carries there, too.
Thank you.
Moving on the Green Corridor Legacy Program on R2, there's some minor technical changes. The House added or successor after the Southwest Initiative Foundation, and this is something is done throughout the House side. And we also added some references to the Constitution and to the outdoor recreation system, just putting the statutory or constitutional references. For the Prairie Heritage Fund recommendation, again, you'll see the addition of or successor and then the native vegetation language. On the bottom of R3, the accelerated prairie grassland wildlife management area acquisition, that is the same. And then we just spoke about the northern tall grass prairie, and that those are the same, except for the House had the statement about federal ownership. The bluffland prairie, the same, just the addition of or successor after Minnesota Land Trust. The Rum River Cedar Creek Initiative, that's the same. On the forest project, there are some differences. I'll let the Senate go through the differences from the council recommendations. The House, the only addition that we had was at the very end, starting on line 5.34. We required the commissioner to certify in writing that sound management of such land is assured and sufficient assurance is contained in a legally binding language of any agreement, and then requiring that to be published in the state register.
And Madam Chair, on the Senate side, a couple of things. On 4.31 to 4.32, you see that the Senate actually uses the proper name of the program and provides a statutory reference. And then also what the Senate does is appropriates the second year with a contingency. So there's $20 million the first year, as was recommended by the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. But an amendment, Senator Saxhog in committee over here, added the $16 million in the second year. And you'll see instead of the language on the closings on the House side, this was to provide some certainty to get the deal actually accomplished this summer. On 5.7, starts on 5.7 on the Senate side, it says the fiscal year 2011 appropriation is available only for acquisitions that by August 15, 2009 are subject to a binding agreement with the commissioner and matched by at least $9 million in private donations. As you discussed earlier, there is a consideration of $9 million for this. So what the Senate language does is appropriates the second year with a contingency that they have to have an agreement by August 15th of this year with a binding agreement with the commissioner to make sure that the deal gets accomplished this year. Otherwise, the second year money is not available.
Moving on then on page R6, the wetlands projects. The first one there is exactly the same. The second one, there's just the minor addition of or success for it after Ducks Unlimited. And then, again, the same issue on the accelerated waterfall production area program and the shallow lake. And then the rim on the bottom of R7 is exactly the same. And R8, there are some differences, and I'll let I believe the Senate is just the council recommendations. And on the House side, originally it was proposed that the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation would administer the small grants program, and on the House side, they had changed it to be the DNR and kept most of the same purpose language and that. And then they did add that there should be some priority for existing WMAs, and they did add the native seed language again.
I think Madam Chair, the other key here is if you look on page R9 on 8.12 to 8.28, the Senate maintained the language that was adopted by the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council. And it does have, including a selection process and allowing members to become part of that, but no more than four members to become part of the selection process. And I think a big issue for the House has been the overhead costs there, making the DNR do it for 2.5%, whereas the Senate language, as was approved by the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, has it at up to 6% available for the grant management expenses.
On the top of R10, this would be the AMAs. They're the same. The Trout Unlimited project, there's just the minor addition of or successor. On the Dakota County Habitat Protection, that'd be the same. The Lake Rebecca project, again, the same. The Fulton Lake Fish Barriers would be the same. And then Subdivision 6 on R11 for the contract management, that's the same. for the overall administration, the House side has less of an appropriation, 403, versus the council recommendations of 695. And then the transfer for reimbursement for the cost from 2009 is from the Water Rec account versus the Game and Fish Fund. And then on the House side, there is a, on the last sentence there, starting on 1133, you'll see that the full-time equivalents are limited to 1.25. And then you'll also see that the we've stricken Lessard from Outdoor Heritage Council, and that's taken care of in a number of places on the House side. And then there's some Senate.
Well, Madam Chair, if we just also go back, I'm not sure, do you know why the House is talking about transferring to the Water Recreation account when the Game and Fish Fund was actually used? In the Senate side, we have it's being yes. transferred to the Game and Fish Fund, and that's the fund that was actually used for the current expenses of the Lessard Council, but the House has Water Recreation account.
Yes, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Knopf. We had moved House File 18, which I believe was Senate File 119, or it was Senator Anderson's bill. And as that progressed through, the language on there were questions. The department was using the Game and Fish Fund, and I don't know if Commissioner Meyer is still here, but was using the Game and Fish Fund. But because of questions on the federal match with the Game and Fish Fund, what we were trying to do with that bill early in the session was to provide for the reimbursement and that it would come from the Water Rec account. I think that it hasn't been reimbursed. The Game and Fish Fund has not been reimbursed from the Water Rec account currently, and maybe Mr. Becker can. So the intent was not to use the Game and Fish Fund. We're kind of talking about where we're at right now, not to use the Game and Fish Fund throughout this whole process because of the questions, the threat that could make to funding. So Water Rec was supposed to cover that. But I think the status quo is that Water Rec is not covering it, that it's still Game and Fish. So but I'd like DNR staff just to state that.
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Becker.
Bill Becker, temporary staff to the council and DNR employee of 33 years. The current expenses are being paid out of the Game and Fish Fund.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Knopf.
So it should be transferred to the Game and Fish Fund, not the Water Recreation account.
That is correct.
And, Madam Chair, the Senate includes on 11.12 to 11.18, this was an issue that was brought up during the discussions of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, is that because they're tied up in the local government practices for public meetings, that it could be construed that the even when they're traveling on a bus or just in travel mode, that they would have to invite everybody else in. And this was providing a limited exception to that open meeting law so that they wouldn't have to invite everybody on the bus or into their dinners or whatever when they're traveling to and from the sites. There was some concern that if you read technically that law that they have to live with as far as the open meeting law, which is different from the legislative open meeting law, that this is just providing a narrow exception to that. And I see the House doesn't carry that, but it was a recommendation of the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council.
And you thought that was all right?
Well, Madam Chair, it seemed to be, to the council members, it seemed to be okay. I mean, they're the ones who voted for this language. I mean, it's Madam Chair, what it does is it's a very limited, I mean, the question is if they're taking a bus or something to visit a site, do they have to invite everybody from the public and notice that meeting and even provide a record of that meeting? So there was some concern that if you read the open meeting law, that they're, that's been assigned to them, that could cause some problems for their traveling.
I would think so. Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, we like efficiency and saving money. It would not seem to make much sense for the council to have to drive to a site, say, in three vehicles when they could go in one vehicle.
One bus.
Or one bus, whatever the vehicle they're using.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, are we taking testimony on this now?
Not right now.
Thank you.
Please continue, Ms. Taylor.
The subdivision 7 availability of appropriations, that's the same. And then on R13, the cash advance, the House narrowed this, this permissive language allowing the transfer if the fund went into some cash deficiencies to just the forest project, whereas the Senate has the original recommendation that it would be for all operations of the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Madam Chair, if I could just make a comment on that. The reason this was
Mr. Knopf.
The reason this was put in by the council in the form that it's in the Senate wasn't necessarily for the forest easement acquisition. It was put in so that on July 1st that the council would have operating money to continue its work.
Representative Hansen, was that in your bill, 18?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just talking to Representative Davids about, are we doing the walkthrough? Are we giving the explanations? Are we just going through the purposes and reading through and comparing? Or
we're doing the comparison right now.
Okay, so we're on which line?
Madam Chair, members, it's R13. It's 12.616 on the House and 11.30 on the Senate. Okay.
Ms. Taylor.
Moving on then to Subdivision 9 accomplishment plans. The only difference is we strike the Lessard project requirements. On page R14, you'll see on that clause 1 starting on 13.2.1 and 13.1, there's the native seed and vegetation language that Mr. Knopf had mentioned earlier, and there are some slight differences between the House and Senate. I don't know if we want to go into detail on those. On R14, the only other difference is we strike Lessard. R15, same. They're identical except for that. Moving on, R16, the first two clauses there are the same. And then the House has an additional clause 7, and this would require this disclosure of any long-term costs that the state may incur, such as, pilt or land management costs to be disclosed. And then there's some differences in Clause 8 for the Minnesota Conservation Corps. The House added some additional language that would, in addition to giving consideration, they would need to make timely written contact. And then there's an additional Senate language.
Madam Chair, yes, on 15.1 on the Senate side, you'll see that they can waive the application of, this was another recommendation of the council, they can waive the application of paragraph 8, clause 5. That's some of the disclosure language that you'll see that has on both sides. It's above on page R15, clause 5. That was, again, a recommendation of the council. It's comparable language to what's in the LCCMR appropriation bill.
Okay. Ms. Taylor, can we go back a minute to the 14, page R15, I think it is, and is starting at line 1433 House and 1410 Senate.
Mm-hmm.
You said those are all alike.
They are, Madam Chair. The only difference would be on line 1411, we don't have Lessard, or the Senate has Lessard, and we don't because of the name change.
Right, and then down in what?
And then
1421, that's the same too?
Right.
And isn't it interesting that the House is the same, except we have the Outdoor Heritage Council, and they have the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, but that's the only difference. But in the letters that the House has been receiving from various people, they pointed out that this language is offensive or unwarranted, that it discourages landowners from giving land to the state. And it's the same on both sides. Go on, Ms. Taylor.
Yeah, that's a little bit different.
On the bottom of page R16, the payment conditions, and then moving on through R17, these are all identical. And then on R18, the only difference in the land acquisition restrictions is the Lessard term. And then same with R19 and R20. And then the House does have some additional language on the bottom of R20, reports to finance. And this requires reports to be that are submitted to the council to also be submitted to the Commissioner of Finance to be put on to a website that provides searchable expenditure data. I believe a similar provision has passed as part of the state government finance appropriations bill. Then on R21, Section 3, this appropriates some money to the through the legislature, the LCC, and then the legislative auditor to fulfill some duties that are established later on in Article 5. And then Section 4 is a reviser's instruction to get rid of the remaining Lessard.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Before we move on then to the next article, so I think, again, in terms of the governance, you've got appropriations. Are they always to the LCC? Is that in terms of the oversight or whatever it is?
LCC, okay. And legislative auditor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I missed that. All right. And then, as Ms. Taylor points out, I know this is a matter of contention a little bit, but and it's not simply because he's a former member of the Senate and the predecessor to Senator Saxhawk, but as I understand it, the name change was proposed originally by Representative Kahn in terms of using living people. Is that is that kind of the policy issue?
No, actually, it's a constitutional issue. The Constitution talks about the four funds and talks about the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and we consistently talked about the four funds rather than the councils that were, or the people that we were getting recommendations from. And so we always have called it Outdoor Heritage Fund because the Constitution relates to the fund, and the Clean Water Fund, and the Parks and Trail Fund, and the Arts, Culture, History Fund.
Well, Madam Chair, I didn't mean to belabor this, but then in the reviser instruction on R21, it talks about the Outdoor Heritage Council. It remove references to Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, replace with Outdoor Heritage Council.
Mm-hmm. And at the time that went in, that had passed the House of Representatives and had a vote of the full House of Representatives.
But then the other question I had is that I think I read or heard that the concern was, could you name such commissions, whatever, after people who are still living?
That was the state government finance position, yes.
Okay. I was thinking maybe if the House would adopt the Senate position relative to the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, we could, if we prevailed, we could maybe rename it the Lessard Cohen Outdoor Heritage Council, was my thought. But maybe that's a bad idea.
I thought it might be the Anderson Cohen
Lessard Heritage Council. Okay. So that would be, I'll have to figure out what the acronym is and figure out what works out best.
But I think going on forward, we should just not point out the differences in the name any longer. We know that you're saying it's the Lessard, and we're saying it's the outdoor, and let's go for it not point it out anymore.
No, Madam Chair, the serious part of it was just I wanted to understand what the...
Right.
Make sure I understood the issue, so I wasn't to belabor the point.
And it did pass the House of Representatives.
Okay.
Madam Chair, didn't everything pass the House of Representatives in here?
That's in
here. I'm just curious.
That was big. A couple of things were really close.
Madam Chair, relative to that, I'd point out that our bill had a vote of 67-0 on the Senate floor. But We can discuss that later.
Yes, we will.
Then
Article 2, Ms. Taylor.
Page R22, that's the start of Article 2. I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, maybe before you go into Article 2, just give you... What you can see on R22 is that the Senate summed up the totals by agency here. One of the big differences in the Senate side, and you'll see the language might look a little funny when it's being compared, is because the Senate actually chose to appropriate the money by function rather than by agency. And so this provides a summary of what each agency received. So as we go through it later, we do match up the language, but I just wanted to make an overall comment that there's a significant difference in the organization of the appropriation, whereas we organize it by functions, where the House organized it by agencies. And this was our summary page of what each agency was receiving under that scenario.
Then
function by.
Moving on to R23, then there's just some technical differences between the two top sections there, and then there's money differences. And then, as Mr. Knopf mentioned, it'll be a little bit harder to follow. There'll always be technical differences between the riders. But paragraph A on the bottom of R23 is similar to paragraph B on the Senate side, except there's, you know, money differences. And then the House does require a report and does focus the project a little bit more on analysis. Moving on to R24, the first paragraph B is for monitoring of pesticides. And there's also on the Senate side, paragraph A on the previous page is similar. There's no appropriation. It's just part of the overall total, I believe.
Ms. Taylor, excuse me for interrupting, but Senator has told me that something big has happened. And they have to go to caucus.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to recess the meeting until at least 9 o'clock.
And I apologize, Madam Chair, for asking if we could recess a little. I know you said you're in session at 5:30 and you intended to quit, so I apologize for
we
doing
have
this
caucus
a little
at 5:30.
Okay, I apologize for doing this a little bit earlier, but. This will be relatively important, and certainly we can keep everything here and come back at 9 o'clock.
Madam Chair, is there a way, what's the best way for members to find out if we are, if and when we're reconvening?
We have it's my full intent to reconvene. I've been given 2 hours. It depends on what time we start for the pension bill. And 2 hours have been allotted, so I think I'm pretty safe in saying by 9 o'clock, but it will be post. I think we should come back and finish our agenda tonight, unless it gets way late. But this same thing that is causing you to caucus is going to be causing us to caucus also. And so... I am not in control of that, and so we will have it posted. Mr. Chen will have it posted, or as we go along, we'll say it's still on, or it's postponed a little bit later, or whatever.
And
we'll be in contact.
Chair, where do you post it?
On the House website.
Email and website, but I don't know what website, Mr. Chen.
Okay, we've got it covered.
Madam Chair, we're not scheduled to be in session tonight, so whenever you're ready, you just let us know. And we can keep everything here, and we'll make sure the door's locked so that that won't be a problem.
Right.
What did they say? Are we?
All right.
Thanks.
Really upset last night. I'm going home. But I had to go to caucus first.
Sounds big.
Well, his brother's that little.